Okay. Oh, but you're supposed to.
Yeah, today Mike Hopkins is going to talk about topological field theory, an informal continuation from yesterday, I suppose.
Okay. Well, thank you, everybody, for coming back. That's always a really good sign. But I realized as I was preparing this talk that I had way more aspects of this I wanted to convey than I do time. But I think the important, or what I think of as the useful thing that we've done, is to take kind of philosophical ideas that are pretty easy to have and actually kind of give clear, real mathematical formulations and really find ways of digging in and proving the theorems. And so with that in mind, I think what I really wanted to get into today, I mean, I really have two choices, but what I wanted to get into was sort of the actual structures we actually work with and just give you a little bit of the flavor of how these things, how we manipulate them. I mean, the other possibility would be to talk a little more about what the theorems mean, but let me start with the actual structures that we work with. So let me remind you in rough terms what the first theorem was. And the first theorem said that that zero one-dimensional topological field theories with values in C are equivalent in some sense to dualizable objects in C. And so this is really supposed to be a theorem that we're going to approach using the techniques of algebraic topology. So I want to define all these things and set them up in such a way I can do algebraic topology with them. So first of all, what's C? C is supposed to be an infinity one category, or a one infinity category. And it's supposed to be symmetric monoidal. And I have to have this notion of dualizable. So in order for me to make sense of this, I've got to do four things. I have to define this notion, an infinity one category or one infinity category. I think the right way Jacob has me convinced is to call them infinity one categories, because it's a up to infinite coherence version of an ordinary one category. So there's a lot of terminology that gets used in this case.
Yesterday you wrote the same thing, the dash between the infinity and one, that's the same thing.
Yeah, that's right. I think I put those in parentheses, but I think probably this is the best way to do it, because this parses the right way. So it took me, right. So I want to define this for you. I want to define what it means for it to be symmetric monoidal. I want to tell you what a dualizable object is. And then, once I've done that, there won't be time, but what I should do is tell you how zero and one manifolds form one of these. And I'm going to do that, yeah. So I'm going to say what the nature of the equivalence is. So all that. So let's it's all supposed to be done in a way that's supposed to feel like we're just doing algebraic topology. So there are many ways of modeling this notion. And the one slightly unfortunate fact of life is that the model which I'm going to present that's most convenient for the general theory is not the model in which most examples occur. So it's going to be hard. I'll give some indication of how manifolds fit into this picture, but the way which manifolds come up and form one of these infinity categories is sort of slightly different from the structure I'm going to describe. But okay, so look, this is a notion that's ultimately combinatorial. So I'm going to start by telling you. So I really want to. I need to start with some kind of combinatorial model for topological spaces. So that's the theory of simplicial sets. So this we're going to think of as a combinatorial model for the algebraic topology of spaces. All right, so what is a simplicial set? So a simplicial set, X, is supposed to be a collection of sets, Xn, where Xn I'm supposed to think of as the set of n simplices in X. And it's combinatorial, so there are some maps relating these. And so let's just think about it. If every time I have, this is supposed to be the set of n simplices with a chosen ordering of the vertices. So to every one of these, to given an n simplex and a number between 1 and n, there's a face. I can form the ith face of that, and that's supposed to correspond to a map from xn to xn minus 1. So I'm supposed to have an ith face map where I goes from 0 to n. And in a simplicial set, I'm also allowed to talk about degenerate simplices. So given an n minus 1 simplex, let's say it's the one involving these vertices, I can get an n simplex by collapsing this n simplex along this edge. So this gives me a map. So that means I also need to record the data, what are called the degeneracy maps, I equals 0 up to n minus 2 in this case. And they're supposed to have some relations between them. So in papers on simplicial sets, when you want to just indicate that something's a simplicial set, people will draw. There's two face maps. A one simplex has a leading and a trailing edge. And there's one way of degenerating a zero simplex to get a one simplex. And people will draw the data like that. There's a slicker way to say it all. That is, if delta is the category of finite ordered sets, and let's let n stand for the ordered set 0 up to n, then a simplicial set, that's the same thing as a functor from delta into sets. Okay, so I've probably gone on too long about that, but what you want to think of, the kind of thing to bear in mind is that I've specified the data in a simplicial complex and I've ordered all the vertices. Now, I made a statement that people make a lot, that the theory of simplicial sets gives you a model for the algebraic topology of spaces. But that's sort of not quite true, and it's a little oversimplified. So there's something that goes wrong in the theory of simplicial sets. This is not quite true. And the thing that goes wrong is that simplicial sets don't have the homotopy extension property. So not all, in other words, you know, if I have a, I might have a simplicial set and I might have a map into it. I might have a subcomplex. I might have a map. I might have a homotopy on this subcomplex. And there's no guarantee in the world of simplicial sets that I can extend that homotopy to all of L. And so it's a, that's sort of one of the cornerstone maneuvers of algebraic topology. And you really can't do much with simplicial sets kind of raw. So it was a beautiful idea of Dan Kahn's in the, I think it must have been in the mid-1950s or the late-1950s, that the simplicial set satisfying a very simple criterion will have the homotopy extension property. So these are called Kahn complexes. So let me just write down the definition and explain the term. So X is a Kahn complex if each horn can be filled. All right, that's the way you say it in English. How do you say it in mathematics? That means every time I have a map from the K horn into X, it can be filled by a map of a simplex. Well, now I've said it in mathematical symbols. What do those symbols mean? So in this picture, delta N is the standard N simplex. And VKN, that's the union of all the codimension 1 faces except the one opposite the kth vertex. So for instance, let me just make a picture. These pictures will be useful later. So there's a zero horn of delta 2. So that will be, that'll be the union of all the codimension 1 faces except for the one opposite the zero vertex. There's a one horn in delta 2. And then there's the two horn. Okay. So, look, this is supposed to be a little bit of a review or an introduction if you've never heard it. But the upshot of all of this is that simplicial sets satisfying the Kahn condition or Kahn complexes are they're a very good place to do homotopy theory. And Kahn complexes, you have a homotopy extension property, and all the apparatus of algebraic topology works. And you can study the homotopy theory of spaces purely combinatorially using Kahn complexes. So this is our good combinatorial model for topological spaces. This is the one I wanna build from somehow to model infinity categories. All right, now so we want to model categories. So every category, suppose C is an ordinary category. Every category
I don't know if you have a one sentence answer to this, but my entire life I've never understood why a Kahn complex was better than just an ordinary simplicial complex. Why keeping track of the degeneracy maps and so on was useful. Simplicial complex is also a perfectly combinatorial way of looking at the space.
I do have a one-sentence answer, but I'm having aphasia, and I can't come up with that one sentence right now. Darn it! Let me try to come up with a simple example. Now it's going to be on the web forever. Then I didn't know how to answer that question.
Sorry.
It's all right. Okay.
You could go to my next lecture.
What's that?
You could come to my next lecture. Okay. The same thing.
I'm gonna. All right. Suppose C is a category. Out of a category, we can make a simplicial set. So a category gives us a simplicial set called the nerve of the category. And so the zero simplices are the objects. The one simplices, those are the maps. A two simplex is a, let me draw it as a triangle, but really this much data determines the rest. So it's the two simplices are the composition triangles, or if you want, since this arrow is completely determined by these, it's the set of pairs of composable arrows. And in general, the n simplices is the set of n tuples of composable arrows. Okay. So let's just ask ourselves the question, this is the prototype object we want to understand. I can certainly, I have a combinatorial device that captures the notion of a category. Is it one of these Kahn complexes? So I need to check this. So, let's see. Let's look at these particular horns. So, I've done this before, so I'm gonna I'll rig it. Let's do this one first. So, every time I see that picture in a category, that means I have two composable arrows. I can compose them. That's exactly what I can do in a category. So this thing automatically, so here's a two simplex in a category. Here's the one horn. Every one horn can be filled in the nerve of a category. So in fact, it can be filled uniquely. What about the zero horn? So the picture of the zero horn is that I have two maps like this, and in delta 2, I would be, let me call this map H. I would I'd be trying to solve the equation H equals G composed with F. So I can solve that equation uniquely, provided one of these two maps was an isomorphism. So if I was in a groupoid, I could solve this. But in a general category, I can't. And similarly, I can't fill the two horn. Okay, so that's supposed to motivate the following beautiful definition of Boardman and Vaught. And they say a simplicial set is a... So now there's a lot of different choices of names for this. So I think they call it a weak Kahn complex. They called it... some people call it a quasi-category. And you might also... It's going to be our model for infinity one categories. So if every inner horn has a filler. So inner means if K is between 0 and N. So that's exactly what happened in the nerve of a category. The inner horn could be filled but the other ones couldn't. So this is one of these things that seems like a little combinatorial trick. I mean, why just excluding the end horn, the end horns would really capture the notion of a category. But it actually does. So, I don't know. There's something wrong, I suppose, with all of these. Weak con complexes is, I mean, I wouldn't want to have something called a weak Hopkins anything. So I don't think this is a kind of a good idea, but quasi-categories are okay, and in fact, that's what's used in a lot of the literature, except it's not notation, it's not a terminology that would, you'd have to invent something new to talk about the infinity version of two categories, etc. So infinity one categories or infinity categories is a good way to go, and I'll try to remember just to use this term today, even though I might slip and use one of these other words. Okay, so that's the beautiful thing, that a simplicial set, that's the world, that's it. That's the world we're going to do homotopy theory in. It's going to be simplicial sets, and we're going to be focused on the ones that are called, that are these weak con complexes or quasi-categories. Okay, so that's where we'll do homotopy's theory. So that's our definition. So that's the definition of an infinity one category. We're going to do homotopy theory there. So we have the same objects. We can think about them geometrically. But notice, let me just point out right away that every con complex is an infinity one category. In fact, the being a con complex is a stronger condition. And this corresponds to spaces being like groupoids in the way that these infinity things model categories. So every morphism in a space is invertible, and in this picture, the con complexes are the infinity one categories that are groupoids. All right, so let me just, I want to go through and give you sort of a little bit of the flavor of how the algebraic topology of these things works. Let's think about a couple things. So let's compare con complexes or topological spaces. So I'm gonna look at X, and then we're gonna look at compare structures when I think of X as a space or con complex. And then I'm going to also write down a list of structures when it's an infinity one category. So I'm going to make a long list of these. So let's see. The first thing is one important thing are homotopy groups, some of the fundamental topological invariants. So in a space, I have pi 0, which is a set. I have pi 1, which is a group. And then I have the higher homotopy groups, pi 2, et cetera, and higher. These are abelian groups for n greater than or equal to 2. I haven't given you definitions of these yet, but in the infinity category case, pi 0 is really just a set. Pi 1, is also going to be a set. Pi 2, as we'll make sense of it, will be a group. And the higher homotopy groups will be abelian. But I'm not really being careful as I just write down this information. And in fact, in topology, it isn't really right. It isn't really the best thing to talk about homotopy groups, because you have to pick a base point to do that. What you really want to do to really do the homotopy theory of spaces is identify a structure that absorbs this choice of base point as well. So in a space, what you really what you really look at is the fundamental groupoid of the space. Or, if you want, the path groupoid. And the higher homotopy groups are modules or representations of the fundamental groupoid. And what happens for one of these quasi-categories is that pi less than or equal to 1 is a category. And in fact, what you really need to look at is stuff that involves the 0, 1, and 2 simplices, which will form something called the fundamental 2 groupoid. And all the higher homotopy groups are some kind of modules over this. So before this gets too mysterious, this really isn't a very difficult difficult fact. The fundamental groupoid, or the fundamental category, it's got objects, the zero simplices of X, and the maps are given by the one simplices. And the composition law is given by the two simplices. And that forces that, so it's going to be just like the fundamental groupoid. I'll have this will impose some equivalence relation on the set of one simplices that it'll tell me that certain one simplices give me the same map, and if I want to compose two maps, well, this is exactly the kind of two simplex I can fill. So if I want to figure out what the composition of these is, I fill in this horn and I define that edge to be the composition. So these are all going to be equivalence classes of these. Well, I don't know. So I know it's hard to absorb a lot of new definitions all at once, and I think maybe it's better if I just tell you kind of how things work. So the next important piece of the next important maneuver in the theory of topological spaces is obstruction theory. And that's what we use to prove our theorem. So let me just remind you a little bit, or tell you a little bit about obstruction theory for topological spaces. So that's the thing that lets you calculate homotopy classes of maps, or determine the homotopy type of a space of maps between two spaces, is obstruction theory. And what this tells you is, so here's one formulation. Suppose I have a map I'm mapping one cell complex to another, or a simplicial set. Say I'm trying to map K into X, and I've defined it on the n-1 skeleton, and I want to extend it. I'm imagining trying to extend it over the different skeleton. So I meet a couple things. I meet obstructions in the cohomology of K. I mean, to extend here, you know, what's the usual argument? For every n cell, the obstruction to extending this map over that n cell is the homotopy class of the boundary sphere mapping into X. And so that's an element in Hn of K with coefficients in pi n minus 1 of X, and the choices are in Hn plus 1 of K, Hn of K with coefficients in pi n of X. That's classic obstruction theory. Now, again, we're exactly, that's classical obstruction theory as long as the space K was simply connected, and which is sort of the easy case. We're exactly not in that case. We're exactly trying to model something that has non-trivial stuff happening in dimension 0 and 1. And so it's really important that I talk about this obstruction theory in the more general case. And what I really have is this map, these elements, these homotopy groups. If I think of pi n of x as a group based at a point of x, and then allow that point to vary, this really forms a local system on x. And this is cohomology with coefficients in that local system. Okay, so it's a little bit of a miracle, but the same style of obstruction theory actually works in this world of infinity categories. So the same, let me just say, the same Steenrod style obstruction theory works for these infinity one categories. But the key twist, the key new ingredient, is what comes of this notion of a local system. So that's one of the features I just wanted to say a little bit of a word about. So what's a local? So except for I have to modify the notion of a local system. So what's a local system on a Kahn complex? A local system. I have to modify this. So let me tell you remind you what a classical local system is. It's to each element, to each point or each zero simplex of x, I get an abelian group mx, and to each edge that starts at x and ends at y, I get a map from mx to my, and these are supposed to compose. So every time I have a triangle, this map from mx to mz is the composition of, it factors as like that. So that kind of data is the notion of a local system. And if I'm on a Kahn complex, because I can reverse these paths, these maps will be forced to be isomorphisms. Okay, so if you're trying to see how this works for infinity categories, you actually derive the notion of local system by trying to make sense of the notion of homotopy group and seeing what happens at as the base point moves around. And so if you follow that procedure for an infinity one category, you're led to to something that seems like a really new notion, which is a local two system for a quasi-category. So what is a local two system? This is something that associates to every two simplex, or sorry, to every one simplex. So a local two system associates to every one simplex an abelian group. Which I'll call M sub E. And every time I see a two simplex, like this, so let's call these edges F, G, and H. So the vertices are ordered, so they'll be like this. Every time I see a picture like this, I get a map from MF into MH and a map from MG into MH. So the picture I carry around is that I I have one of these abelian groups sitting over each edge, and I can drag them, I can push them forward when I compose on this side, or I can drag them back when I compose on that side. And so that's the data, just like in a local system, we had data on every vertex and on every edge, and that data is subject to a constraint, which is the thing that makes it local, and that says that every time I have a three simplex, the ways of dragging, well, let me just say plus a constraint associated to every three simplex. Okay, so with this notion, you can write down a cochain complex with values in a local two system, and let me just say obstruction theory works. So this isn't...
Is there a distinction from the topological example that the, you know, there you had a space and sort of both the space and the thing, the obstructions lay in, the homotopy groups came from the space, but here these M's are an auxiliary.
These M's are describing the general notion of a local two system, but the homotopy groups in the case of one of these infinity categories are turn out to form a local two system.
Oh, I see.
So I'm a little, I don't want to make this.
I see.
So I can, let me just expand on that for a second. So one of the, it actually doesn't look like obstruction theory is going to work when you start out thinking about this. And that's because in this world of quasi-categories, the simplices aren't contractible. In fact, their fundamental category isn't equivalent to the trivial category. The fundamental category of the one simplex is the category with two objects and a map between them. And that's not equivalent So that's the category that just has two objects and a single map between them. Delta 1 is in fact a quasi an infinity category. It's the nerve of a category. And that category is not equivalent to the category with one object. So delta 1 is not contractible, and none of the simplices are contractible. And that feels like, you know, that feels like in topology that's at the very heart of obstruction theory, that you're trying to extend a map from a sphere to a disk, and since the disk is contractible, that's the same thing as asking if the map of the sphere in was null homotopic. So it's right at the heart of the definition of homotopy groups.
Are we missing a map?
Yes, we are. Thank you. That's not contractible. So that's right at the heart of the definition of homotopy groups. Well, it turns out that the right definition of homotopy groups is to look at just equivalence classes of maps of a sphere in modulo those that extend over the disk, and just not try to relate that to the notion of the map being factoring through a contractible space. So if you start with that, you start with calculating homotopy classes, maps of the boundary of a simplex in modulo those that extend, you wind up exactly with one of these local two systems. So I don't know. It's just it was a new notion that came up, and the obstruction theory worked like magic with it. And I just wanted to pass on that there's a nice, at this level, generalization of the notion of a local system. And it has a very easy formulation. Okay, I'm just going to tell you obstruction theory works, all right? And you can write down an explicit cochain complex just like you do for calculating cohomology with coefficients in a local system. All right, so you may be in despair because I had all these things I was telling you I was going to define for you, and so far I've only done one of them. But so let me just do the other in a way that doesn't give you the definition, but that tells you such a definition should exist. So I wanted to talk about the notion of symmetric monoidal infinity one category. And remember, in this picture, so a special case of an infinity one category is a Kahn complex. So every notion I define for these infinity one categories will restrict to some companion notion for topological spaces. And conversely, I might be able to just, if I'm lucky, take some notion of topological spaces and just, it might be that the definition simply applies in this more general situation, and I will, and I'll get the correct definition in the infinity one category case. So what is a symmetric monoidal structure? It's supposed to be a category with an operation tensor from x cross x to x that's supposed to be infinitely homotopy, commutative, and associative. So infinitely homotopy, commutative, and associative. Now, so that, if I restrict that to a topological space, the topological space equipped with this structure is exactly an infinite loop space. And in fact, any one of the, and that's a, so recognizing infinite loop space as the machinery for doing that's highly developed. And any point of view that on infinite loop spaces will generalize, just directly generalize and apply to these. So I'm just going to say that it's something with a multiplication like this that's infinitely commutative and infinitely commutative and associative up to homotopy, and just ask you to believe me that there's a sort of well-developed way of making sense out of that that directly follows from the case in topology, in which case it's describing an infinite loop space. So we'll just use this sort of colloquial kind of picture. So that's the notion of symmetric monoidal. And then the last notion is what it means for an object to be dualizable. So what does it mean for an object? So let me make a simple point that if X is symmetric monoidal, a symmetric monoidal infinity one category, then the fundamental category of X is an ordinary symmetric monoidal category. I just borrow the tensor structure from X, and it passes through to the equivalence. So I'm going to make a definition that an object in X is dualizable if the same object is dualizable in the fundamental category. So what I have to do to complete the definition is tell you what it means to be dualizable in an ordinary symmetric monoidal category. And that, I guess I talked about that a little bit last time, is that in a symmetric monoidal category, V is dualizable means there exists a W, a map from V tensor W to the unit of the tensor product, a map from the unit into W tensor V, such that the two diagrams such that this is the identity map and the other one's the identity map. Okay, So, you know, these are probably things I know when I first heard them, I had to go and think about them. They're hard to take in on the fly. So the thing I want you to come away with, well, there's two things I want you to come away with. One is that our notion of being dualizable doesn't see any of the higher homotopy theory in X. It's just a condition about being in the fundamental category. So if we were back in the world of spaces, it would be like saying, you know, X has a special property if it lies anywhere in a certain path component. We've imposed a condition that's cutting out path components, but it's not cutting into the higher topology of the spaces, the higher homotopy theory.
So Mike, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I've kind of been under the impression as a person who works mainly in finite dimension that infinite loop spaces were kind of hard to come by. Is that also the impression of somebody who likes infinite optics, or are they sort of common garden variety?
An abelian group is an infinite loop space. Z mod 2 is an infinite loop space with two points. So those are examples. Any topological abelian group is an infinite loop space.
I'm thinking about cohomology.
Right. So any space that represents a cohomology theory is an infinite loop space.
Right. But it just as a point of intuition, it seemed to me that most spaces don't represent cohomology theory in some.
Yes, but
I'm just trying to get a sense for how restricted this condition is.
It's not a restriction. It's a space equipped with extra structure.
I know, but not every space can have that space.
That's correct. Yeah, right. So let me see. What I'm leading up to is a careful statement, and then I'm going to give you a discussion of the architecture of the proof. But I never even gave you a careful definition of a topological field theory. So the careful definition in this language would be the following. I'm not going to have time to quite define this. Let me call this. So this will be an infinity one category of zero and one manifolds. So you're supposed to imagine that the objects are oriented zero manifolds. So the objects the morphisms are cobordisms, but oriented one manifolds, and the higher morphisms are represented by diffeomorphisms. Okay, so that you can make precise, but it doesn't fit. I don't want to make it sound hard because it's not. It's just it would take me, you know, another 10 minutes to kind of fit it into this framework of definitions. But there's one of these, and it's symmetric monoidal. And the symmetric monoidal structure is disjoint union of manifolds. So a one-dimensional or a zero plus one-dimensional topological field theory with values in C, where C is a symmetric monoidal infinity one category, is a map of symmetric monoidal infinity one categories from board 0, 1 into C. So it's true that this structure is, you know, not every space is an infinite loop space. It's structure that's been imposed, but it's those are the only ones. I need that structure just to even talk about
sure.
That as the objects as possible values for the field theory. I mean, I'm not saying anything deep. I had to every manifold, I'm supposed to get something, and then disjoint unions go to some composition of the somethings, and that composition defines a symmetric monoidal structure. So among those, I could talk about ones with values in an infinite loop space. So in this framework, there's really a whole space of maps. And it's really actually a classical topological space. It's really a con complex, not one of these infinity categories. So
for fixing, saying all the maps, you're fixing C, and then
I'm saying this, fixing C, the space of all maps from here to here. So there was one point I was just about to finish over here before I stopped to answer that question. But am I being confusing?
No.
Okay. All right. So I didn't finish something about, I haven't extracted for you the space of dualizable objects. And there's a little technicality because the name is slightly misleading. So if V is dualizable, then the dual is characterized uniquely, or up to a, in classical category theory, it's characterized uniquely up to unique isomorphism. In this world, it's characterized up to a contractible space of choices. So let me just say characterized. So there's a little bit of ambiguity. If I talk about a dualizable object, I really get two objects. But if I want to talk about the space of dualizable objects, I have to talk about what I mean by maps between them. And what I mean in this case is a pair. So when I talk about the space this is supposed to be the space of pairs VW plus duality data, which is that data. And that means, so this has a very minor but significant technical effect. What is a map of those? So a map of VW to V prime W primed is going to be a map from V to V primed and a map from W to W primed respecting the duality data. Well, look, think about these as imagine these are vector spaces and this is the dual vector space. Then if I have a map from one vector space to another and a map from its dual to the dual of the other, then the dual of this map is a map going in the other direction. And if it's compatible with all the duality, it forces this map to be an isomorphism. So that's the little technical thing. So this forces V to V prime to be an equivalence. Now, back here, I said V determines W, but if I talk just about an object V, the maps between V's don't come with companion maps between the W's. Only the isomorphisms do. So let me just say the space of dualizable objects. So the space in C is it has objects, dualizable objects, but maps equivalences. So it's a con complex. I'm falling back on this language of categories, but I probably should have said everything in the language of simplicial sets. But let's just point out, I just want to notice that being dualizable only involved the zero and one simplices, and a map being an equivalence only involves something about the one simplices as well. So all the conditions I'm imposing, they're like cutting out a path component, like I said before, except it involves a little bit of stuff about paths, but nothing in the higher topology. Okay, so so the main theorem, if you want, so now I've defined everything in some sense of the main theorem, and that is that, inside in board 0, 1, there's the positively oriented point, a point with one orientation. And that's dualizable, as I talked about last time. Its dual is the negatively oriented point. And so given a map, given a topological field theory, which is a map from board 0, 1 to C, let's call that Z. Z of a point is a dualizable object in C. And so I get a map from the space of topological field theories with values in C. To the space of dualizable objects.
But
yeah.
Does it also involve looking at the negative point in the interval? Didn't you just say that the space of dualizable objects has that extra duality structure? I mean, it's not just the object, it's some choice of dual.
So I think I didn't say this clearly. Let me try to say it again. It's just a linguistic point. When I say space of dualizable objects, it makes you think I'm just picking out certain components. I'm just looking at certain objects, and I'm allowing arbitrary maps between them, arbitrary maps between the maps and higher. And as you just noticed, I also have a Z of minus. So I don't get just an object, I get its dual. But the only... that dual object is characterized up to a contractible space of choices. So the only impact that has on the structure I'm giving is that it forces the maps I'm looking at to be isomorphisms. So I could have said it's the space of dual pairs, and maybe that would have been the cleaner way to say it. And the maps of dual pairs are what I said there. That happens to be equivalent to saying it's the space of objects that have a dual and maps between them which are isomorphisms. Those are homotopy equivalent spaces, and I think this just rolls off the tongue faster, which is why we've been using that terminology. But I think you're right, and it's probably misdirecting to say it that way, and probably the cleaner thing to say is I'm giving you a value z of plus, a value z of minus, and those form a dual pair. Okay. Is that okay? But the space of dualizable objects looks like a bunch of path components of my original space, but where path component involves something about the vertices and something about the edges, but then allows all the higher simplices.
I was just thinking, I mean, the naive way of thinking of the topological field theory is you need some object or space for the positive interval point, some for the negative interval point, and something for the interval.
Yeah.
And I'm just thinking, are you, if you unwrap those definitions, are all those three things given, or do you just pick one of them and somehow the others are determined up to homotopy, and so it's not necessary.
Once I've specified one of them and I know it's dualizable, the rest of the data is determined up to what does it mean for a vector space to be dualizable? It means it's finite dimensional. And if I have a finite dimensional vector space V and a W that fits into this thing, that plays the role of its dual, In fact, W is isomorphic to the linear functionals on V, and the data takes a standard form. So the W and all that data is equivalent. Once I knew the thing was dualizable, the rest of the data was determined up to unique isomorphism. I don't want to drag on way over time, and I want to give you the punchline here. So you make a map. This gives you a map, and I've got to prove that it's an equivalence. And the way I'm going to prove it's an equivalence is by in this language, let's do it by Whitehead's theorem. So we'll prove it's an equivalence. I made a choice of exposition early on that's coming back to haunt me a little bit here. I thought about obstruction theory from the cell-by-cell point of view instead of the Posnikov tower point of view. But so let me just say, let's say it this way. So let me introduce some new category. I'll call it omega for now. So this will be defined. So this is going to be an infinity, a symmetric monoidal infinity one category, with the property that maps, preserving the structure from omega into C is the space of dualizable objects. In C. Okay, you can make such a thing. And the reason I keep harping on this condition, this fact that the condition of being dualizable just involves stuff in low degrees, it translates into telling you that omega is just built as a symmetric monoidal infinity, whatever category, with a small number of cells. So this thing only has cells in low dimensions. So omega has cells only in low dimensions. And that means the cohomology of omega with coefficients in any local two system is zero for star bigger than some small number, which I think turns out to be two. It has low cells, so no higher cohomology. So we have a map from omega to board 0, 1, and we prove it's in it. So the main theorem is that this map is an equivalence. So we need to show that this map is an equivalence, and we'll do it by Whitehead's theorem. You prove that it's an isomorphism of fundamental groupoids, or in our case, fundamental two groupoids. So that's a combinatorial fact about diffeomorphism classes of zero and one manifolds. And the next, the hard step, the key step, is to prove that it's an isomorphism with coefficients in any local two system. But what does that amount to? That amounts to saying, since this one is zero, that amounts to saying that so this is equivalent to saying that the cohomology of board 0, 1 with coefficients in M is zero for M any local two system. And this is something that you can directly do. So, all right, I know this was a little technical, but I wanted to give you some flavor of what really goes into really setting this up. And I wanted to convey that it really is learning to do algebraic topology in a world in which not every path is reversible. So in that world, you set up obstruction theory, and the whole argument, the whole theorem, boils down to knowing the cohomology of some kind of cobordism space. And even in ordinary topology, these spaces, you know, understanding the cohomology of these spaces was a very interesting part of getting at cobordism invariance. And I think these are extremely interesting calculations to make, and we haven't gotten very good at them. But I'll just tell you, this winds up being there's an explicit chain complex you write down with manifolds as inputs, and you somehow have to prove it has no homology.
Where's the irreversible path in that formula? Is it in M? Is it in Bohr?
It's in Bohr 01, this path. Right, this path doesn't have it can't be reversed. If I compose it with the one going the other direction, that composition is not the identity path, which would have been that one. Do these pictures make sense? Here's a path from here to here. There's an obvious one going in the other direction, but if I concatenate them, I don't get this. There is a cobordism.
You have a morphism that's not invertible.
Yeah.
The morphism from 2 points to 0 points.
Yeah, I keep using this. Yeah, I keep using the wrong, a word that's misleading also.
It's reversible but not invertible.
It's an adjoint. And then, as we talked about before, there is a cobordism relating these, mm-hmm. but that involves an illegal topology change. That involves a cobordism.
Because higher up, you only allow diffeomorphisms.
Higher up, I'm only allowed diffeomorphisms. Okay, look, what this calculation encodes, although roughly, is what this calculation is measuring is the difference between combinatorial models for diffeomorphism groups and the diffeomorphism groups themselves. And it winds up being zero because in this dimension those combinatorial models are models for the diffeomorphism groups. And in the two-dimensional version of the theorem, we input the same kind of information. But our ability to deal with this stuff is still pretty primitive. But I guess I just wanted to convey to you, that you know, it really is a chapter in algebraic topology, but it's algebraic topology of sort of really different kinds of objects. And in investigating it, we're starting to turn up sort of new universal kinds of calculations that look to be pretty interesting. So I guess I'll stop there.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions?
Sure.
So, is it possible that you'll learn things about? Will you learn only about the homotopy type of diffeomorphism groups, or will you learn something about the group structure? Like, for instance, the group of diffeomorphisms of the circle is simple. Is that going to play a role here?
I don't think so. What we'll learn about is the homotopy type of B diff.
Okay.
That's the sort of manifolds with corners. And that reminds me of, something I wanted to ask Mike, but...
Any more questions? So, yes. Thank you, Mike, again. Thank you.